Captain, we will. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Yvonne. Have a good morning.
Right, good. I will. You too.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to Labrish. My name is Haftus Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest and is a The Jazz Map production. Can we find this thing here? Oh, it was the other fellow who was playing. See? So I think it will go like this now, right? See? So as I say, yes. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. Stay tuned for Arv the Wolf with Jim Freund, who is coming right up, and Mr. Tosh.
Be, yeah, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. Got to put aside name organization. Got to put aside. There will never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, at all. We also got to realize we are one people. Yeah, got to realize that we are one people. Yeah, we got to realize we are one people. Or there will never be no love at all.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, oh yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, nobody's here. Well, Eugene hasn't arrived yet. Otherwise, we've got altered fluid and an entire writer's group. This is one of the most thrilling things we do on this show, so you gotta stay tuned. Oh yeah, Tempest's gonna read.
If I ruled the world, I would dream up inventions. I'd throw out the rules, disregard all conventions. I'd make this world happy and peaceful and bright, and all of us would sleep much better at night. First thing I'd demand would be a car alarm. Easy to install, but hard to disarm. It would be silent on streets and in parking lots. Instead, it would only go off in the car owner's bed. Really, nobody else needs to be woken up just because somebody's walking a teensy bit too close to your car. I want a fast-forward button for those boring times when spending hours with knuckleheads drives you out of your mind. Simply point it and zap them, zip right to the end of their dull observations and they're leaving. But then I'd like a slow motion button to make good times last and slow down some boyfriends who still go too fast. Kisses would be sweeter, hugs more healing, would come in handy when making gravy, keep those lumps from congealing. I'd invent something for one of those awkward attacks when you leave a stupid message on voicemail and you can't take it back. Simply click and rewind for quite a brilliant remark that will impress the callee and perhaps win his heart. Oh, I wish I had an alarm on each shoe that would beep if I was about to step in dog do. Just a slightly higher sum, it would bang if my shoe was near moist bubble gum. Really, if they can tell you that a hurricane is 500 miles away, couldn't they tell you that a itsy bitsy little natural disaster is just 2 inches from your foot? I'd want a buzzer on my mirror that will warn if my hair is a horrible mess or if I need Nair. The deluxe model will have a speaker that shouts, lock the doors, bolt the windows, you can't leave the house. I want a sensor in the ladies' room that discreetly knows when you've tucked your dress into your pantyhose. This happened to me in a really fancy place. You should have seen the look on the maitre d's face. Ooh. It was that sign of the dove in Manhattan. I'll never forget it. Everybody was staring at me as I was walking across the floor, and I didn't know why. But I'm telling you, if I ruled the world, humiliating things like this wouldn't happen anymore. Wouldn't this be a better place for all of us to live in? I'm sure the diners at Sign of the Dove would agree. Now, Here are some of my more modest inventions. I'd invent an umbrella with a strong bracelet attached. You'd never lose it, and it would come in handy if you're ever in a subway attack. A detector that tells you what's in the Cracker Jack box. An extra 5 minutes on all of our clocks. Every country would drive on the same side of the street. I'd remove all cholesterol from all of our meat. Children would volunteer to take naps. People like me would understand how to read maps. I'd invent a satellite catcher for that inevitable day when your $500 million spacecraft just floats away. A video camera that could tape record your dreams. I'd invent a 100% natural, yet luscious, yet non-fat, and so yummy ice cream. If I ruled the world, I would make these inventions and then think up more at invention conventions. But I don't rule the world, so we'll have to make do with the annoying situations we all muddle through.
I dare anybody in the world to tell me that Christine Lavin isn't just wonderful. Oh, you can say it, but you won't be right. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And let's see. First, let me do announcements. No readings this week, this coming week. I missed KGB on Wednesday, which annoyed the heck out of me because I like to be there. But thank you, Gordon Lindsner, for recording it. So I haven't heard the tape yet, but with any luck, it's something that we can bring you. However, we have so many shows in the can, which is unusual for me to actually pre-record any shows or a bunch of shows, but well, in the case of some people, okay, well, one person, for example, I did something I never, ever do. I did a phone interview because Sherry Tepper is in her 80s and not likely to make it in New York the next year or so. And she has a new novel out. There's Eugene on the monitor, by the way. And at home, you don't care, you know, unless you're watching this room. Anyway, so I recorded an interview with Sherry Tepper, and wow, she's cool. You know, so, and she has a new book out, The Waters Rising. And we talked about her career and things like that. What I am waiting on to finish that is she had recorded on her ranch. Yes, she owns and operates a dude ranch. Actually, I don't know if she owns it, but she operates a ranch in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And from there, she recorded a reading. I'm not going to allow a reading to be done on the phone. That would just sound sucky. So that needs to be redone. And once that's redone, we will have a two-hour Sherry Tepper show in hand. But I also recorded an interview with Karen Lord. And Karen Lord is just way cool beyond belief. Did you bring the egg or do we need a phone? Oh, you have a phone. Fine. Karen Lord was in for the Brooklyn Book Festival, where she appeared on Sunday at 2 o'clock on a panel with Nora Jemison. Oh, I'm sorry, N.K. Jemison, author of The 100,000 Kingdoms and other works that we will discuss this morning as we go around the room. And Gavin Grant arranged for me to interview her on Monday. And she came here, and when 2 hours was done recording, she said, I won't do the wonderful Barbados accent. I thought this was a two-hour show. I said, well, yes, I think we're going to be doing more than one. Keep talking. So, I mean, because she was just, I mean, it was magical. It was wonderful. The discussion, well, you'll hear it eventually. You better tune in for that. At this point, I'm thinking of putting on part one October 2nd, which would be 2 weeks from now. But next week, you see, we have another Island accent. Next week, I won't be here. I have actually produced an episode of the show at home, which I have right here. That's it. A little thumb drive that I've got to put on the computer here. And it's Nalo. It's Nalo Hopkinson. At ReaderCon this year, Nalo was the guest of honor. And I got to do the guest of honor interview, which is like, yeah, it's Nalo, yeah. And I was just thrilled. The one thing I did not get was that there was a panel conducted by Andrea Hairston, which was a discussion of Nalo's work. I'm unable to get that recording. And I also missed Nalo's reading. Ah, but Scott Edelman didn't miss it. Scott Edelman, who's a wonderful writer and bizarre person himself, recorded it on his little flip camera. You can actually go to YouTube and see her reading. But it's going to sound a little like this. But thanks to the joys of equalization and stuff like that, and, oy, a lot of work. I have that reading for you. And I also have a reading from that she did about 4 years ago at Hugh Mann Books, which is up in Harlem and just a way cool place. That was my first time there and not my last. It's really a nice bookstore. And that was a very poignant reading because she was supposed to have been touring with Octavia Butler. And I'm not going to rebroadcast that whole thing. I've broadcast that before. But that will be the extra bonus DVD. So next week, Nalo Hopkinson, guest of honor interview, reading, and a 10-minute portion from Hugh Mann Books. And some weird music that I threw in when I chose my music at home instead of here at the station. Okay. So now next week, this coming week, I was also going to have on the show originally Graham Slight, who's coming into town. He's this wonderful British critic, and I can't do it. So I have to talk to him and figure out how we're going to get him on this show because he doesn't come here that often. And I'm really despondent about this. I'm really like not happy when I schedule people and I have to unschedule them. I've also got John Sprunk coming in, another person that Gavin ordered me to put on the air. And I generally have learned you do what Gavin says because he's never steered me wrong. He's also throwing Kathy Koja at me. You know, yeah, twist my arm. Okay, enough. We have a lot of people here. Two other quick items. Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. It's now a movie you may have heard. And I said before the movie came out, I said, reread the book, close your eyes and remember it, because this is the last time Frodo Baggins will not look like Elijah Wood. This is the last time Gandalf will not look like Ian McKellen. Nothing wrong. This is great casting. They did a fabulous job. Even Galadriel worked, you know, Kate Blanchett, not like in the Bakshi version. It's, you know, sorry, Ralph. It mostly worked, and from, you know, a Tolkienite, which I think I am, and we'd still broadcast the Council of Elrond every December on this program, as a result, it's been burned in. But Radio City Music Hall last year, they were doing Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring with music. And they offered tickets over this show to give over the air, and I got to attend. And I thought, yeah, right, okay, you know, like movie with some orchestra and all that. And I'd seen something like that before, and that really didn't cut it for me. And when I got to Radio City Music Hall, I saw the screen. It wasn't the big Radio City Music Hall screen. It was a decent screen, but there were all these people in front of it. And you couldn't see it that well. And then, Fellowship of the Ring starts out very quietly, flutes and stuff like that. But then, all of a sudden, the orchestra comes in, and I realize this wasn't a movie. This was a concert, and it was bleeping amazing. I had a great, fabulous time. Rumor has it that we might be giving away some tickets on this show on October 2nd. Be warned. So that'll be like a call-in at random kind of thing. So, and if anybody in this room wants them, you're going to have to call in like everybody else, okay? So, and if you want more information, they're doing them a year apart. That's a long time to wait. So the next time out is October 8th and 9th at 7:30. I don't know which performance we're going to have tickets for, but we'll have tickets for something. And for more information, you go to the Radio City Lotar concert.com. That's the Radio City, LOTR, as in Lord of the Rings, concert.com. Is that a mouthful?
Yeah,
yeah, really. That's a lot. Okay. And
a friend of mine is actually in the chorus.
Say again?
A friend of mine is actually in the chorus.
Oh, really? That's like it's like a 100-person chorus.
Yeah.
200-plus musicians. It's larger than a symphony orchestra. It is amazing.
They are rehearsing now. They just got the Elvish translation guidelines and trying to figure out how to pronounce much of the music. So if anybody is an Elvish expert out there, you know, get in touch with me. And
actually, I may be able to help to a certain extent, but I'm going away. I'm going away today. Going up, but that's which is why next week's show is pre-recorded. So, but I actually at one point Valar helped me. I actually could read that, and of course the thrill of my life. And I won't go into the whole story. But once we had to figure out when we were producing the Council of Elrond how to do Orcish. So Baird Searles, who was doing the reading for us, and my ex-boss, gave me a phone number, and he said, well, call the professor and ask. So I spoke to Tolkien.
Oh, wow. Nice.
I spoke to Tolkien and, you know, got the pronunciation. And it's, you know, and whenever I'm in the presence of people like that, it's like the time that I interviewed Ursula K. Le Guin, all I could say is, Garsh. you're wonderful. Really insightful interview, you know. But I do have it on recording.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'm proud of that. I mean, I didn't say anything, but Brett Saltz gave me his phone number, and I called him, and he answered his own phone and everything. So, so I know like 5 words in Orcish. Yeah, but I actually did go through the appendices and learned Elvish at some point, and did the whole Silmarillion thing. Lord help me. Anyway, the final announcement is, oh my, it's already 5:20. The final announcement is that, yes, I am doing a show. Yes is Yom Kippur, which is one of the reasons why our numbers here with Altered Fluid are diminished this morning. At least a couple of the members of Altered Fluid felt that in their hearts it just would not be right to be doing radio this morning, and technically neither should I. I am not a religious person, but Yom Kippur has a meaning. It has a depth, and I am the son of 2 Holocaust survivors, and well over 30 people in my family were killed during World War II, or before World War II, but, you know, as part of the whole, well, thing in Germany. And, you know, father from Nuremberg, mother from Frankfurt am Main. You figure it out. German Jewish family. Yeah, right. But something that my father had taught me is that it's all between you and God. And this, you know, so I'm in my way, there is remembrance, there is meaning in the holiday. I am not doing it the way it is written in any scripture, any testament, anything like that. But Matt Pressel said he'll atone for me for doing the show this morning. So we'll start with that. And to other people who are observant today and not listening on, you know, stream later, I guess the closest thing one can say is may your fast be meaningful. And I will say, if I have done anything that was sinful in this last year, I'm sorry for most of it. Well, it depends on how you define sin, doesn't it? Speaking of which, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial radio at 99.5 FM. Okay. How do writers, you know, end up being so cool in their writing on this show? Where do you do it? I have to explain this every time. A writer's group is, for some people, a critical thing, in some cases, a support group. Different writer's group have different methodologies, different dynamics depending on their makeup. But mostly it is a way for people to convene and hear what each other do. Usually one person, or in the case of, like, I know the Tabula Rasa group, they'll do like two or three different of the writers in one session because they only meet monthly, merely monthly. Mary Robinette will send a story, and, you know, Rick Bowes, and then those two will get critiqued by everybody else in the group. And this is a way for professional writers and aspiring professional writers to analyze stuff. So we've brought that to the radio. This is the Hour of the Wolf version of a reality show. I can think of nothing more frightening, given the fact that somebody's soul and heart are in the stories that they are writing, to not only read a first draft of a story on the air, but then to allow people to critique it live on the radio, and if we have the time and the guts, take phone calls. And this is Chris Steichman started. Good morning, Chris. Sorry to wake you. started this whole thing off. What, about 4 years ago? At this point, how long ago?
4 years ago? I think it was 4 years.
Who? Yeah, have we all gone at this point?
No.
Except the newbie.
No, Raj hasn't.
No, I did.
Raj went.
I haven't read a story either.
Oh, you did. That's right.
Raj,
yes,
took my place. I was supposed to read.
That was it. Right. Okay.
He did a better job. Mm.
But we will go around the room and introduce everybody, because this is a, well, they're young people, so I'll say this is like an awesome group. And but they are. There isn't a person in this room, including a new member, Tom Crosshill, whose writing doesn't thrill me. I mean, there isn't somebody in here whose byline I wouldn't see and go, oh, I've got to read that. And you will be given an insight into that. Now, one person who has actually been on this show, and sooner or later, everybody, by the way, everybody has to have their turn in the barrel as a solo guest or a duo guest. That includes you, Chris. You know, just to do a show as an individual and not just, you know, part of Altered Fluid or... Oh, yes, some of you were here. Actually only who else was here for Sybil's Garage?
I think it was just me and Eugene.
Yeah. Wow. Because Devin couldn't make it this morning. Matt couldn't make it this morning. Paul Berger couldn't make it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but we are not diminished. We are simply...
have more seating.
Yes, almost a mic for everybody, if not headphones. So, Tempest Bradford, who was on this program just about a year ago last, on your own, yeah, reading Until Forgiveness Comes, soon to be a radio drama near you. We do have to talk a lot about Andrea Hairston, who's going to direct it, and basically it's going to be thrilling, but anyway. It's your turn this morning, and I guess it's time for me to shut the up. Good luck on that, by the way.
Well, I guess I'll start, since I'm the one who's in the hot seat this time. My name is Kay Tempest Bradford, a science fiction fantasy writer, as well as a writer of some other stuff, blogger. I'm internet famous. It's very exciting to be internet famous. And I've had stories appear in Strange Horizons, Electric Velocipede, Sybil's Garage, Interfictions Anthology, Federation's Anthology, lots of really cool stuff. And this year, my story that was in the Interfictions Anthology is going to be reprinted in a fairy tale anthology coming soon from John Klima, who's going to be the editor. And that story is also going to be on Podcastle. I'm not entirely sure when, but it's going to be sometime in the next few weeks. And it's going to be read by my good friend Amal, which I'm very excited about. It was one of my favorite stories. So yeah, that's me. And you can find me online at ktempestbradford.com, except not right now because the server's down. But, you know, someday.
I was going to geek at you about it, you know, because our server was down this week, and I've been wondering. A lot of servers have been down again, so I've been wondering about that. We should probably go around the room now and introduce everybody.
I'll go next.
Okay, excellent. Let me put a mic on. There we
go. I am David Mercurio Rivera, and I am primarily a short story writer. I've sold about 16 stories since 2006 to markets including Inner Zone, Black Static, Nature, Electric Velocipede, and many others. And I also work as an associate editor on Sybil's Garage with Matt Kressel. And I've been a member of Altered Fluid since, I think, 2003 or so, or 2004 perhaps. And you can read all about me at mercuriorivera.com.
And we also need to mention, by the way, alteredfluid.com.
Yes.
That's true. Alteredfluid.com will tell you all about all of us.
Stuff.
Except maybe Tom.
Good to get Tom on the website. Go ahead, Eugene.
Hi, this is... good morning. This is Eugene Myers. I write as E.C. Myers. I have mostly been focusing on writing young adult science fiction fantasy for the last few years. I have a novel out on submission. I have had a couple of short story sales recently. My Father's Eyes is in Sybil's Garage number 7. I was on Hour of the Wolf a few weeks ago talking about that. And I have a new story coming up in Shimmer Magazine number 12, I think, called All the Lonely People. And my website's ecmyers.net, still slightly under construction, but all of my story sales and biographical information is available on the website.
So. Mention Gotham Lit.
Yes. thank you, Jim. You always remind me. I also co-moderate the Gotham Lit listserv in New York City with Ellen Datlow, which basically publicizes literary science fiction, fantasy, tangentially genre events. So if you have anything, you can... email us and we'll post it on the list. And we also now have a Twitter feed, which is Gotham Lit. That's
it. And that reminds me, everybody, an announcement I didn't make. October 5th, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Shanane McGuire and Catherine M. Valenti, as curated by Rose Fox, new curator for us. That's we have two new curators, Rose Fox and Ron Hogan. So, like, yeah, okay.
Nice. And I am N.K. Jemison. I publish as N.K. Jemison. I have a number of short stories that I've published since about 2002 or so, one of which was up for both a Hugo and a Nebula this year. The Non-Zero Probabilities was what it was called. It didn't win, but that's okay. I'm incredibly honored that I got double nominated.
The experience of watching the Nebula was excruciating. we'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah. The Hugo was much easier. I just woke up and discovered that I hadn't won. I also have a novel out called The 100,000 Kingdoms. The sequel to that, The Broken Kingdoms, is coming out in November.
And the name of that whole series?
The whole trilogy is called the Inheritance Trilogy, not to be confused with a certain other inheritance cycle by a person who shall remain nameless. That's pretty much it. I've been a member of Altered Fluid for the last 2 years, I think.
Who's next? Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom Crosshill. I'm the newest member of Altered Fluid, having joined about a month ago or so. I'm a Latvian writer living in Brooklyn these days. I've had stories appear in magazines such as Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Sybil's Garage, and Flash Fiction Online. And I'm very excited. I'm a Writers of the Future contest winner, and our new anthology, volume number 26, is coming out just now. So look for my story, Seeing Double.
Oh, very cool. I didn't realize that. Why is it that good people end up being treasured by Scientologists? I don't know.
No, thank you.
Well, that's a whole other thing. But I always have a thing about the Scientologists and Writers of the Future. And yet they really do wonderful stuff. And Andrea Kail won. And, you know, so congratulations.
Well, it was, I have to say, they put on a great show. It was an awesome experience. And as far as Scientology goes, I didn't hear that word mentioned
they really,
the time I was there.
They really do steer clear of it. As far as those people are concerned, they're publicists. On the other hand, if they should call, say, a radio talk show host, it's another story. And that will be for another show. So, Rajan.
I'm Rajan Khan.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Keep talking. But,
okay. sorry.
No, it's not. I'm sorry. It's the microphone that I'm complaining about.
Okay. Mm. Right now I have a couple of stories that are available. I have a story in a new online magazine called Basement Stories. The address is the URL is basementstories.org.
I am barely picking you up
on
the mic. Yeah. Do me a favor. Tap that microphone. Well, it's there. Talk louder.
Should I...
Or could you repeat your name?
It's you know what? The mic is intermittent because
all right, I'll switch to a different mic then. If that's
I think so.
Okay. Hi, can you hear me now?
Good.
All right.
Rajan just entered the room.
I'm Rajan Khanna, as I was saying before, but the microphone interrupted me. I have a story currently available right now in a new online magazine called Basement Stories. Basementstories.org is the URL. I also have a story in GUD magazine, or Good magazine, however you want to pronounce it, issue 6. The PDF version is available now. You can pre-order the print version, and an EPUB version is coming soon. And I have a story coming out in the Way of the Wizard anthology, which is a John Joseph Adams edited anthology from Prime, which is due out in November, which has a great table of contents, including Ursula K. Le Guin, Neil Gaiman, Jeffrey Ford, people like that. I also do narrations for podcasts. I've done a few for Podcastle, including stories for our members, Saladin and Nora. And
Saladin Ahmed, who's not here this morning.
And I also am doing a few podcasts coming up for Starship Sofa, which just recently won a Hugo. And that's me.
And Starship Sofa is supposed to have an interview with Saladin Ahmed. I know because I was there when they interviewed him, but I don't know when it's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, Tony does a lot of interviews, and he has a lot of content, so he has, I think, some great stuff coming up in the next months. So.
Chris.
Can you hear me now?
Barely.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, actually, if you could point that mic down, there you go, that's much better.
How are we doing?
Excellent.
Okay. So, speaking of Saladin Ahmed, who can't be here because he's home taking care of his twinfant overlords, before I introduce myself, I'll name check everybody who's missing. Aliyah Don Johnson, Matt Kressel, Paul Berger, Devin Poor. We have our satellite member, Greer Woodward, who's in Hawaii, and our other satellite member, James Tremarco, who is in the wilds of Brooklyn. And then there's me. I'm Chris Dykman. I'm one of the founding members of Altered Fluid, having taken a class with Terry Bisson at the New School back in 2001. I have had stories published in Sybil's Garage, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Strange Horizons. That story was just reprinted in Tim Pratt's excellent anthology, Sympathy for the Devil, which also has a terrific table of contents.
I just got that in the mail.
It's a great. I'm very, very happy to be part of that. And you can also find me up at Podcastle. And my website is chrisdykman.com.
Excellent. Okay, I think that covers those who are present. So I think we need to turn the mic over at this point to Tempest, who is going to go to the next part of our journey and read.
Okay.
You say okay, but the mic doesn't respond.
Silly mic.
Yeah, really.
Tricks are for kids. So my story has a very temporary title, which is Going Rogue, which I accidentally misspelled Going Rouge, and everyone laughed at me. But that's the temporary title, Going Rogue. Brunch was supposed to begin at 11, but the captain knew full well that none of her companions would arrive before 11:15. So she made herself comfortable, legs propped up on the chair next to her, mug of coffee precariously balanced near her knees, and went over the latest damage and artillery assessment reports from her second in command. She normally liked working in her private dining room as opposed to the small, cramped cabin off the bridge. The art embedded into the walls constantly changed, but so incrementally that each new tableau took a day or so to complete. Today, exotic earth fish that no longer existed appeared and disappeared randomly while the ocean water around them slowly grew darker. This made for a welcoming ambiance, but the report before her was so tedious that a fish that took over 5 minutes to move an inch had the power to distract her. The commander was meticulous and efficient, to his credit, but even with the state of the defenses, the captain still had to wipe away tears of boredom that crept into the corners of her eyes, and the coffee wasn't helping enough. When the door swooshed open, she didn't even need to turn to know who it was. The major was always more punctual than the others, even though she was just as bad at delegating important tasks to her underlings. She stopped just behind the captain's shoulder to frown at the data pad. How many sections have you read? 12. And I'm not half done. She was about to point out a particularly egregious subsection on dress code violations when she noticed something even more worthy of note. You cut your hair. You don't have to sound so shocked, the major said, dropping into the chair opposite. I don't think I've ever seen you in a different hairstyle. The captain grinned and relinquished her relaxed pose to lean forward in mock confidence. Are we attempting to attract someone new? Funny. The major ran her fingers back through her now short pixie-cut hair and seemed a little disconcerted that there wasn't more to it. I just got tired of worrying about it. Even as short as it was, I still had to do too much to it in the morning. I know what you mean. Well, suits you. It's a bit darker, too. Dye? No, she said, frowning at the suggestion. It gets redder as it grows out. I think it's the lighting on this ship. The door swished open again, and Dr. Jones entered, two teas in hand. Sam's getting the croissants. Chocolate or almond? The major asked. Almond. Wow, you cut your hair! Why is this so shocking? The captain pulled out a chair for Jones to save her from getting herself in trouble with the answer. How's our patient? Sedated. It looks like nothing happens while they're unconscious, but I've got him on a million monitors, and they'll call me if his status changes. Let's keep him asleep for the foreseeable future. As promised, Sam entered with the croissants, four plates balanced expertly on her arms. Did you wait tables in a former life? The major asked. Worse. I served on a rig with poor inertial dampers and wonky gravity generators. I can balance anything, she said, passing them each a plate and giving special care to the doctors. Anything. The captain hid a smile behind her mug as Joan's whole face turned a redder shade of brown. Where are the boys? Busy trying to perfect the poached egg technique. I think we're getting the most beautiful eggs Benedict ever created. Nice hair, by the way. Sam mussed her own blonde pixie, which wasn't as regimented as the major's. Why'd you dye it darker? It's not dyed. Her hair gets redder as it grows out, apparently, the captain said, a smile teasing the corners of her mouth. Oh, yeah? I always thought it was the same reddish-brown as yours, Jones nodded toward the captain. And on that, when are you going to do something new with your style? The twist is better than the bun you have, but it's not exactly exciting. Yeah, change it up, Sam said. Ask one of the girls in the salon to give you a daring and rebellious makeover. Then command will put this all down to a new hairstyle. They've been stupider, the major said as she saved her last bit of croissant from Sam's encroaching fingers. They're probably having meetings about our hormonal imbalances. Not just yet, the captain said. Communications are still down, right? Sam nodded. Everyone's working on the engines and weapon systems. Communications are way down on the list, and they'll follow my priority order. You're letting them work when you're not down there? I'm shocked, Jones teased. I have Alana mostly trained, after only a year, the major said into her cup. Her hair is quite nice, the captain said. It is. It's just the right amount of fluffy and curly. Sam ran fingers through her own hair again, making it stick up a bit. If I had hair with that kind of body, I wouldn't have to wear it like this. The doctor just shook her head, her lips pressed in a half smirk. You all know her hair is fake, right? It's not! How do you know? Serene at the salon told me. I've never seen her there, the captain said. Of course, I don't go much because Serene always wants to do something different with my hair, which usually involves making it stick straight up with green on the tips. Ilana doesn't have to go to salon because she doesn't need to. Jones was about to dish the dirt when the door swished open and their brunch entrees finally arrived. The ladies exchanged amused glances as the most perfectly poached eggs atop perfectly toasted English muffins arrived at the table, garnish, sauce, and bacon arranged more artfully around the edges than they'd seen even in a lifestyle vid. You boys certainly outdid yourselves this morning, the captain said as one of them refreshed her coffee. Sam examined all sides of her dish. So where's the best place to poke it so the yolk runs out this way? As one of the chefs explained, the captain leaned closer to Jones. So how does Serene know her hair is fake? It's the wrong texture. It should be thicker, kinkier. Like yours? No, just tighter curls, but it would feel like mine. The captain resisted the urge to plunge her fingers into the doctor's swept-up afro, knowing that she really hated it when people did that. When you say fake, do you mean a wig? Sam asked as the boys retreated. No, that would be obvious. She had it retexturized, I bet. That's big now in D-Colony. Don't let her hear you call Dominica that, the major said after poking her egg so the yolk ran out that way. Or anyone else. We're going to need them in the near future. And you're one to talk, Sam said. I've seen pictures from when you were a med student. Your hair was straight then. Hey, I was young and misguided. I can't imagine you with straight hair. This suits you so well, the major said, aiming a fork at her head. Thank you. Jones struck a pose and grinned. Ilana has been on this ship for more than a year, yet she still feels the need to stay retexturized, the captain asked. Well, yeah, no one's going to give her crap for it, except Serene, not to her face. Gotta love gossip, the major said. Plus, as far as she knows, this assignment is temporary like any other. She doesn't know she'll rise up in rank enough that her hair and what it says about her background won't matter. So going back to something natural doesn't seem like an option. They all let that sit for a minute while finishing off their eggs Benedict. All right, then. What should I do with mine? Should I just let it hang long? Put it in a ponytail? No, no, no. Cut it. If you do it just about shoulder length, it would frame your face really well, Jones said. With a little bit of layering, that will give it body. The captain could practically see gears turning behind Sam's big blue eyes. You mean my old hairstyle, the major said. You didn't have layering, it just sort of sat there. No one ever told me that. And don't be like her and act like your face is afraid of your hair. Jones cocked her head in the major's direction. Lay hang in front just a little bit. But no bangs. Definitely no bangs. The captain looked between Sam and Jones. You've both put quite a bit of thought into this. Have you been discussing my hair behind my back? Only a little, and only in the most respectful manner. Sam smiled her cutest, most mischievous smile. The captain sighed. All right. I suppose this means I'm going to the salon tonight. Excellent. We'll come with you. The major shook her head. You all have spent way too much time thinking about this. Speaking of, she pointed to the chronometer cleverly integrated into the art. Shift changed in 10. We should get to the bridge. The captain nodded and finished off the last of the muffin. We should. Ladies, it was a pleasure, as always. I'll see you at the staff meeting. And tonight, at Serene's. It had been 3 days since the captain had her hair cut, and in that time, she'd already developed the annoying habit of reaching up to tuck it behind her ear every time she had nothing to do with her hands. At first, she didn't even realize she was doing it, but it only took one comment from her second-in-command for her to start being self-conscious, something she didn't need at the moment. Or ever, really. Now each time she caught herself, she cursed softly and wondered if pinning it back would earn her too much grief from Sam and Jones. For the moment, she was keeping her hands busy with a data pad and a letter she was attempting to write. It was proving harder than she thought. Uncharacteristically, she was second-guessing every word and phrase, writing, then rewriting again. She blamed the hair. When the door swished open and let in a waft of the savory odors of the dinner still under preparation, she turned, expecting to see the major. Instead, Sam strode in and, even more of a surprise, was not in uniform. New outfit? Do you like it? Sam was a bit uncomfortable in her new threads, though the deep cerulean really complimented her eyes, as well as the beach scene emerging in the walls. The fitted jacket and matching slacks were covered in dozens of pockets in varying sizes. I had one of the tailors make it up for me. I wasn't sure how well it would work, but I had this inspiration. Let me guess. Pockets. Many, many pockets. So I can carry all my kit. Every tool gets its own space. She demonstrated the easy open flaps on her legs. And I can grab anything fast. It's a good idea. The fabric feels heavenly. Yeah, nice and breathable and super stretchy. She dipped down into a deep lunge. I was thinking we could replace our uniforms with this. You know, modify the pockets and the style a bit for each department. Why would we be needing new uniforms? Well, it would be silly to keep the old ones, don't you think? Plus, they're ugly. Who ever thought jumpsuits were a good idea? I hate the way they bulge at the waist. Another tantalizing hint of dinner floated in with the opening door, and Sam pulled out of her stretch to let Jones and the major into the room. Oh, is that the new uniform? We're getting new uniforms? The major asked, turning a surprised eye to the captain. This is the first I'm hearing of it, actually. It's a proposed change, Sam said with a conciliatory tone. I love the pockets, the doctor said, twirling Sam on the spot, and it shows off your figure really well. Is this a necessary feature of the new uniform? The captain teased. Clothes that fit well are one of life's necessities, yes. The doctor relinquished her hold on Sam only because the first course arrived and the smell drew them all to the table. The captain tucked her hair back, leaned forward, and reveled in the aroma rising from the small bowl. Is this risotto? When one of the chefs answered in the affirmative, they all made appreciative noises and immediately took their first bites. This is amazing. Sam's eyes actually rolled back into her head. Similar reactions from the other three satisfied the boys immensely, so they left to prepare the second course. Does it seem like they're auditioning? The major asked. Jones nodded. I was just thinking that as well. They don't know, do they? They might suspect, the captain said before savoring another bite of the smooth, creamy dish. The balance between the mild, smoky cheese, bitingly fragrant mushrooms, and delicately spiced sausage was divine. She had to force herself to eat slowly. I think more people have a sense of what's up than not, Sam said in the midst of her equally orgasmic experience. If they're trying to convince us to let them stay, I vote yes. Can we make them wear new uniforms as well? Maybe shirts with a light, tight fabric. Very, very pale pink would look good with their skin, especially that tall one. Sam narrowed her eyes in mock disapproval. Dressing them in your mind, doctor? How unprofessional. Let's get through the next week before we start ordering new uniforms or objectifying the kitchen staff. The major nodded at the data pad the captain had sitting next to her. Do you know what you're going to say yet? I have a terrible first draft. Jones leaned over to peek at the text. Speech or letter? Right now, it's a letter, but the major thinks we should broadcast it instead. I haven't decided, though perhaps doing so will soften some of the harsh edges. Like here where you call the admiral a pig-headed bigot with control issues? Sam nearly choked on her last bite for laughing. That's temporary. I haven't decided what to say there yet. I thought putting in what I really feel would be cleansing. Go with your first instinct and just say it. When the other three turned mildly shocked eyes on the major, she shrugged. The damage is already done. Doesn't matter what we say now. You're not going to keep their heads from exploding over this, so we might as well go all in. They paused as the second course came in, the captain discreetly turning the screen on her data pad off as she moved it to make room for the massive plates the chefs placed in front of them. The roasted duck over spiced couscous smelled even better than it looked, quieting them all as they took in the feast before them. After receiving their due praise, the boys retreated once again, and Sam spied an extra treat tucked in the bed of couscous. Oh, God! Fried wontons! She took a bite and nearly melted in her chair. With goat cheese inside, oh, they definitely stay. My mum used to say that duck fat is liquid love. I think that's what they fried the wontons in, the major said, doing a little melting of her own. The four of them finished the course in the comfortable quiet of well-enjoyed food, broken only occasionally by appreciative moan or sigh. Overcome by a curiosity not even Duck could sate, Jones snagged the data pad again and read from the top in between bites of couscous. In the centuries since humans began interstellar travel, we've made tremendous technological progress, and those gains have helped us reach further into our galaxy than even our most brilliant scientists deemed possible a few short generations ago. But our societal progress has not matched this forward motion, and we find ourselves, as a race, slipping back into outdated ways of thinking about each other and the alien societies we encounter. This should be a speech, Sam said. As words on a screen, it's moving, but spoken it would be more powerful, especially coming from you. Wow, you go into it all, Jones said, scrolling through the lengthy document. The stuff with the Essene, the whole thing about the colonies, gender equality. You're quoting Malia Obama? It seemed appropriate. I know what you're going to say, Jones, the major interrupted. But it all has to be there, especially if we're going to mass broadcast this to the Allied homeworld. And I know you don't think that's necessary, Kath, but I do. Because all Central Command will do is bury it, if they absorb what's in there at all. How long did it take them to realize that every department head on this ship was a woman? They still haven't yet grokked that nearly 90% of the crew and military contingent are either. Even if they did, they'd still have no idea what that means for them. They're just happy not to have to assign any token women to other ships or promote them to the Admiralty because we're willing to take them all. How fracking stupid can they be? The other three leaned back a fraction involuntarily, having never heard the Major swear nor speak so angrily before. It is an affront and a disgrace to every soldier and ship's crew who has fought and died since the Cambria incident that command is continuing on this way, and every human needs to understand that. She scooped up the last of her wontons and chewed on it furiously for a long moment. And this goat cheese is really good. I'll miss it. They make a similar one in Nagana. I'm sure we can get some there, Sam offered. Jones smiled and kicked her playfully under the table. But the captain's eyes were on her closest friend, taking in everything she'd said. The final course arrived, which dispersed the tense mood immediately as the chefs revealed a sumptuous black, sticky rice, generously covered in mangoes and strawberry syrup. The rice, warm and buttery, made the perfect companion to the sweet and tangy fruit. I'll miss this, too, Jones said. We'll have to develop a whole new palate. I get the impression that the boys can handle whatever they have to work with. The captain closed out her speech. She definitely decided on that now, and squeezed the major's hand. I'm off to sick bay to let our guests know that it's time. Then you can bring the communications back online, Sam. I'll go with you. Jones licked the last remnants from her spoon, then followed the captain out. You're still going to call the Admiral pig-headed, though, right? The long corridors leading to the captain's quarters were silent, save for the ever-present hum of the ship, since most of the crew were still either confined to the designated areas or helping transport people to the outposts on the planet below. Still, the captain walked as if every eye in the galaxy was on her, head erect, eyes drilling down the hall, shoulders square, mouth set in a grim line. Even after she entered her quarters and the door closed behind her, she still stood at attention, her eyes on the sliver of the planet she could see through the sole window in the room. Only when its purple oceans disappeared from view, replaced by the inky black of space, did her shoulders slump and her breathing return to normal. When she reached up to massage away some of the tension in her neck, she felt a twinge of grief that passed almost immediately, suppressed, discarded. Playing over the last 32 hours in her head, she felt no regret over her words, actions, or decisions. It had all been necessary, she knew. One day, she was sure she'd feel it as well. The door beeped, and she waved her hand over the lock without thinking. The major stood on the other side, holding a bottle in each hand. Wine or tequila? Wine first, the captain said, letting a smile creep in. When we're drunk, we won't appreciate it. The major set the two bottles on the table by the couch, but didn't make a move to open either of them. Instead, she walked back to the captain and looked her right in the eye. Do I need to reassure you that not only are you not a backstabbing traitor, but that you also didn't and still don't owe him anything? Because it seems self-evident to me, I just didn't know how you were feeling about that. Grateful, the captain squeezed her shoulder. Thank you. She gave a short nod, then went to uncork the wine just as the drawer timed again. Come in. Sam came bearing a bottle of vodka and a grim expression. Without a word, she went and set it next to the other two, landing hard on the couch and keeping her eyes lower to the floor. Are you all right? I am. Almost everyone I thought would stay stayed. I didn't expect to lose Alana, though. Sam scooped up the quarter-full glass of wine the major placed in front of her almost the second it hit the table, draining it in one gulp. Only tequila for you for the rest of the night. Have you seen Jones? The captain asked. She was talking to... through? The Essene. Probably done soon. She flicked her eyes up at the captain. How about you? Are you... I mean... I didn't expect the commander to be so angry. I believe he felt that because we were lovers, he was also my confidant. The fact that I didn't actually confide in him must have escaped his notice. The captain slid into a chair opposite the couch and took a long sip from her now full wine glass. The bouquet was dry and sweet, just the way she liked it. Many things escaped his notice, obviously. This is why I stopped getting involved with men, Sam said. They always make these assumptions, but then they don't want to tell you what they expect. And then they're always surprised when you don't live up to that. Also, they don't have breasts. When the door beeped again, the captain went over to let the doctor in so she could palm the lock once more. You started without me. Jones was only half pretending to be upset. It's just our first glass, Sam said, and made room for her on the couch. You have no bottle, the major observed. I've got chocolate instead. Jones slid three large bars into the table, each with a high cacao percentage and one with hazelnuts. We forgive you, then. Anything interesting from our guest? The captain asked as she started in on the hazelnut bar. No, they just said they were looking forward to seeing us. I'll be glad when we get there, though. It's just odd talking to this guy knowing that I'm actually communicating with someone else so far away. I can't wait. It's just so fascinating to think of a culture that where a man's personality is subsumed into the women they marry. It doesn't work exactly like that, Jones countered. Close enough, the captain said. He's an empty husk except for what his primary pushes to him. It's amazing the distance this telepathic communication works over. However it works, I bet it makes relationships much easier. Nothing makes relationships easier, the major said. No culture we've ever come across is without the equivalent of divorce. Jones swirled her wine a bit, content to just smell it. I wonder what happens to Essene men if they have to separate from their primaries. A secret smile crept across the captain's lips as she imagined the dire consequences of such a scenario. On a different but related subject, we now have just 7 men aboard ship, right? The major asked. Yes. Are we at all worried about potential shortages? They're all young and strong. They can take it, Jones said, grinning. We should drop schedules, Sam joked as she finished off the rest of her glass and reached for the chocolate. You know, to ensure that all the women who are so inclined have equal time. Senior staff gets preference, though, and you should have a favorite that you keep to yourself, Jones said to the captain. I suggest the tall one from the kitchen. I think Serene has already laid claim, she said, and I doubt this will be a problem for long. I've had several messages from the unallied governments with offers to join our movement. I'm sure we'll find ample recruits of all genders once we visit their settlements. After we're done on the Essene homeworld, we should visit the Sioux at the seat of the 7 Council Fires. They have a well-trained militia and a really, really attractive ambassador, Jones interjected. And his son, have you seen the vids since he came of age? The younger one? Sam asked, and Jones nodded enthusiastically. Miles of dark, thick hair and beautiful sandy brown skin. Ugh, but no breasts, the captain said. Amazing abs, though. They all turned to the major, surprised. And just when did you have occasion to see his abs? The ambassadorial residence is on a beach. There was a formal party that devolved. He has an older brother, doesn't he? I heard he's a very inspiring leader and wanted to join the fleet when he was younger. Jones loved it when the captain's eyes glittered like that. She was always much more cheerful when she had a playmate. Then we should invite him to join us. He looked really good in the new uniforms, especially if we get him one in deep maroon. We'll still keep the ship mostly women, though, right? Sam's gaze was on the floor again, but she lifted her eyes to look at each of them in turn. This is the best ship I've ever served on, and not just because I built it. It's because of what we made of it. I don't want that to change. Neither do I, Joan said. Agreed. All her knots unwound and doubts dissolved, the captain saw only wisdom in these words. Then that's how it will be. Joan slid her hand into Sam's, giving it a reassuring squeeze before raising her glass. To our sisters and shipmates, then. And the Essene. To our captain, the major added. And her fabulous crew.
I am woman, hear me roar. In numbers too big to ignore. And I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor, and no one's ever gonna keep me down again. Yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can face anything at all. I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman.
Miles Gone Rogue, read for you by the author, K. Tempest Bradford, here over WBAI, New York.
If I have to, I can face anything at all. I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman. You can bend but never break me, 'cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can face anything at all. I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman. If I have to, I can face anything at all. I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman.
There is a setting for that, at least on the Droid. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City. WBAI at 99.5 FM. There are bagels out front, Ken. I just say that on the air all the time. Yeah, you're so subtle here. Yeah, indeed. Okay, so this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. It's the confessor thing. You know what I'm talking about, Ken? Yeah. Talking about
the most cursed machine in the entire station.
And check this out. That's the keyboard, listeners. It's well, never mind. We have to about 8 weeks out of the year. We have to log every song title, artist, time it plays, and all that live while you're engineering the show. Doesn't matter how many guests you have, that never mind. You have been listening to K. Tempest Bradford reading Not Going Rouge, but Going Rogue, version 1.9, and right. Accompanied by Evo, well-known band Evo. You know, we are not human. We are Evo.
Evo.
Anyway, it's well. You know, you get a bunch of people in a room nowadays and everybody's dumb phone, you know, has got to talk. I was telling about that off the air, and I had my Murph in my pocket, and I was doing a eulogy on the air. In the middle of the thing, I got an email, and it said right on the air, Murph. the phone that dares speak its name. Anyway, with us this morning is Altered Fluid, which is a writers group. Regular listeners. This is what, about our seventh time doing this? Something like that? Anybody here have any remembrance of how many times we've done these so far?
I would say at least five.
Five, I think.
No, more than five, yeah. I think. At least five, yeah.
Well, let's see.
How many in this room have read on the program before already?
Not as part of Altered Fluid.
Okay.
Six.
I think this is
our seventh appearance.
Yeah. So I was right. And at some point, we're going to have to start. I've been talking about this. Mm-hmm. Taking the stories that have been read, because these are first drafts, and taking the stories that have been read, and later on, after they have been revised and published and all that, I'm very curious to see how they've changed. A story that you read on the air, David, was very different when it got published.
That's true, yeah. It started off as something called The Fifth Daniel, and then ultimately it was retitled The Fifth Z and appeared in InterZone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely.
And that might be a fascinating comparison. We might like to do a show, sort of a follow-up, where are they now in terms of those stories kinds of shows. So, would somebody like to describe what happens next?
Sure.
It's David's job.
Sure. Let me explain how the process works. All of us have read the story in advance and prepared our comments. And now what we'll do is we'll go around the table and take turns speaking, giving our thoughts and suggestions. The author must remain silent. Tempest, this means you. Must remain silent while everyone speaks.
Good luck.
We use a timer, so the critiquer has 3 minutes to speak. And typically we'll talk about what's working, what's not working, and suggestions on ways to improve the story. Other critiquers may only say one word while anyone is doing their crit. They can say either ditto, signaling that they agree with what's being said, or anti-ditto, signaling that they disagree. And after everyone has had their turn, then there's an open... Oh, my gosh.
In honor, by the way, of the Evo speaking out during the show, the timer will be an iPhone this morning.
Droid X.
Oh, you got a Droid X. That's right. I'm sorry. Murph. Okay. Sorry.
Well, after everyone has had their turn, then there's an open, freewheeling discussion at the end where, you know, fist fights and things like that ensue. So that should be interesting.
I throw my phone.
So I guess the person who goes first is usually the one who's to the left of the writer, and that person is me.
Favorite.
Sure. So, Eugene, why don't you go ahead and set the timer?
Eugene Myers will be the scorekeeper this morning. I have one word comment. Mischievous?
It's a mischievous smile.
It's mischievous.
Okay.
Not in the future.
Okay, yes, that's probably true. That's probably true because it'll find its way into the dictionary because nobody knows the word mischievous anymore.
Okay, I'll start. I am David Mercurio Rivera, and these are my thoughts on the story. First of all, Tempest, I want to say kudos for going out of the box and writing something that's fairly bold and definitely pushing the fringes of satire. And I think you were going rogue yourself, so to speak, by going non-traditional this way. It reminded me a little bit of an episode of Buffy the Vampire that I remember seeing in which Xander has his own solo adventure, and in the background lurks a larger story involving Buffy and the rest of the Scooby Gang, and that we just get fleeting glimpses of. And in the same way in this story, we just get snippets and flashes of a much larger story lurking in the background involving these aliens, the Essene, while the reader is exposed to just this vapid dialogue between these shallow characters. And you do a good job of telegraphing right on page one that this is going to be a satirical piece. From the opening Captain Janeway vibe to the allusions to Captain Picard's fish on that first page. Now, I'll admit that I laughed out loud when I realized the joke about three or four pages in, namely that this is satire and that the story was going to consist entirely of this vapid dialogue between these women. However, about seven or eight pages in, I thought, oh no, the story is going to consist only of vapid dialogue between these women. So, right now, I don't think that the format is working for me. I think that the problem is that after we get the joke and laugh, that all we're left to focus on is this dialogue, which is not all that interesting. And I realize that's the point. But, you know, the point is, oh, let's look at these superficial ladies talking about their hair and their clothes. But in my opinion, the story is too long for this kind of a running joke. So I think that it's possible for this to work as a flash piece. So my main suggestions are as follows. I would make it much, much shorter, just to lead about half of the dialogue and give us a little bit more about the background plot on the scene, because I realize there is this fascinating plot buried in there about this alien race that consists of women who absorb the consciousness of men and leave only empty husks behind. Now, talk about something that's rife for satire. I mean, that's something that you should focus on a little bit more just because it's so hilarious. And you introduce what the Essene are on page 18 of a 21-page story, so I would move that up. And they should talk about something a little bit more interesting. It can still be superficial, but perhaps they should talk more about relationships and sex, because that's just, I think that would be a more more interesting subject matter. other little stuff that I have. In the opening scene, the captain is reading kind of boring regulations, and then in scene two, she's writing a speech. I would have her writing that speech throughout the piece, just because it's a way to introduce the scene a little bit earlier. When you talk about clothes, it seems a shame not to mention the miniskirts from the old Star Trek. The old Star Trek series. I just wanted to know why they're going to the Essene homeworld. It's not clear that what they're going there to get done. Maybe to nab a husband. That would be kind of funny. And I'll just wrap up by saying that it was very brave of you to try to write something so unusual for the radio show. And you took a huge risk. It isn't paying off, but I think it can pay off by making it shorter and giving us more about the Essene. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to use this microphone. Okay. So I liked the gender reversal here. I liked the space opera qualities of this story. And I ditto David on really liking the background stuff about the Essene and the way that it's kind of filtered into the story in the background. I hadn't picked up on the I didn't have the same connection to the Buffy episode, but that's a really good comparison. I think there's some interesting subtext lurking in this. But it wasn't rising close enough to the surface for me. For me, I wasn't sure how much of this was intended to be a satire, actually. So I thought that it started off a little bit slow, bogged down in details about the room and the captain and her writing this or reading this report, and even she's commenting on the fact that it's boring. And I thought that was probably not something you'd want to do. I thought that the story would pick up a bit when all of the main crew are gathered together for breakfast, when all four of them are there. So that might be where you would want to start the piece. But the story didn't actually really pick up for me. Like David, I discovered that it was mostly this dialogue between these characters, which wasn't entirely interesting. I was a little bit spoiled for this. I think you mentioned that this was supposed to be a Sex and the City or Designing Women riff. I was also getting the Star Trek references. I mean, the captain might as well have been Janeway, and the major was probably a Bajoran resistance fighter at some point. You had B'Elanna Torres' uniforms, and you even had a character named Alana. I don't disapprove. It just feels a little bit light for me. So I wasn't sure if this was parody or criticism of the source materials. Let's see. I do appreciate the effort, though, to, I think, intentionally you're opposing conventional SF narrative here. It feels like a story that has an agenda. I'm not sure what it is. I really liked the background stuff about the Essene, and I think I did not even consider shortening the piece to make it a flash piece like David did. I think that's definitely one way you could go. But I think that you should probably engage with the scene details a little bit more in this. I still like it in the background, but you could complicate the story a little bit. I thought that it might be interesting if this is like a first contact mission with the Essene, and the Essene are there's like that one member who's on the ship who's kind of observing the crew, and maybe a command had to move all of the men off of the ship. So this actually is an all-female crew at this point. And this Essene is hanging out with them as one of the girls trying to understand human culture, but it's a female in a male's body. And then you can do all sorts of interesting things with that, because I liked the gender bending of the Essene. So I think there are different directions you can take this in. I also think you might consider having one of the main characters disagree with the captain at some point or throughout, maybe arguing the opposite viewpoint, and maybe have one of them leave at the end of the story. And I think a better title would be Her Fabulous Crew. So I think you have a lot of potential here. I'd like to know what you were thinking and where you want the story to go. But thank you. And I pass it to Nora.
Ready. Okay, this is Nora here. I agree, Tempest. I think this is really bold. I think I'm trying to get a feel for what you were trying to do, so here's what I'm guessing. I thought that in some ways you were kind of trying to illustrate the Bechdel test, and by doing a satirical sort of opposite of it, that you were building an entire story around the idea that a ship full of women, when left to their own devices, will talk about nothing but men and hair and things that are sort of stereotypical. And I thought that in some ways you were satirizing all those, you know, sort of golden age era SF stories in which women don't do anything but that, Heinlein, for example. Yeah. And so I wondered if that was, you know, deliberate. I couldn't really tell. But because I was still so busy kind of trying to figure out what you were doing, I didn't really realize the subtext until the third read of the story. And at that point, I realized that something has happened to the ship, that, something has happened to the men of the ship. I couldn't tell whether they had been killed off or something else was going on. They have had this first contact situation with the Essene, and they've seen this culture, and they've decided to defect or something like that. So I think that's what's happening. But it was so difficult to figure out amid all the other things that I was kind of, guessing that the story was about, that I definitely would not have caught this on the first read. I probably wouldn't have finished the story on the first read, to be perfectly honest, because I got sort of, like David, I got a good ways into it and was like, oh, this whole thing is going to be nothing but dialogue about food and, hair and stuff like that. And so, I think that you were trying to do something very clever here, but I think that the cleverness, unfortunately, got a little buried in the method or the style that you were using. So I would also agree that you definitely want to shorten this, certainly shorten the dialogue. The descriptions of the food and things like that were interesting, but not enough to hold me, given that I didn't know what was going on. I didn't care about the characters. I didn't have any reason to care about what they were talking about. So the dialogue started to blur at certain points. And the subtext, once I finally figured out that the subtext was actually important, that distracted me from all of the dialogue. I didn't care about the food, for example, because I was trying to figure out what happened to the men. Or I was trying to figure out, what are they actually doing? Are they defecting? Why are they changing uniforms? Are they Essene uniforms that they're going to be wearing now? All of these were things that I was trying to sort of figure out. I did not get the line of nothing happens while they're unconscious. I did not understand why the women were suddenly it sounded like basically gearing up to sexually harass the poor men on the ship, which made me really feel spooky.
Ditto.
And that is the timer telling me it's time to shut up. So the only sort of suggestion that I kind of have here is this isn't a story, it's a vignette. And the story is underneath it and unspoken. I think you need to bring the story more to the fore. And, I understand the exercise that you're trying to do here, but it's getting in the way of the story. So I want to see more of the story. That's it.
You ready, Eugene?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I'm very glad that I'm going after Nora because I very strongly agree with absolutely everything she said.
Who are you?
I'm Chris. I'm Chris, Jim. How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. I just thought the audience might.
That's fine. I don't usually read Alter Fluid stories more than once because I don't read stories in real life more than once. If the author can't sort of get me to it, then they can't get me to it. I read this story 3 times, and I was still absolutely at sea. And I thought it was interesting. Listening to you read it, which I guess is the 4th time I processed it, a lot of things I didn't understand became much clearer when I heard you read them. So I don't know if it was because it was the fourth pass through or because I was hearing you kind of articulate these ideas. I ditto the people that say that you took a chance, and I think that's brave. Where am I? I think the setting is compelling. I think the idea of the story is very interesting. The writing is very smooth. And the food is to die for. But the characters are one-dimensional. The story didn't work for me. Like Nora, I had no idea what was going on. And I really wanted to. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, if it's a mutiny or if all the women simply gravitated to an all-female ship. The tangential details, which really are the story, are way too hidden. I like the idea of a story where the subtext is the story, but in this case, I had no idea what was going on. I finished the story each time I read it with the same idea. You have contempt for somebody here, but I don't know whether it's the kind of reader who likes these kinds of stories or the characters in the story or the writer who writes these types of characters. I can't say that. By the 3rd read, I was ready to suppose that this is that you're looking at these kind of womanly tropes with a jaundiced eye and you're trying to tell us something about these things, but I still don't know what it is. I kept waiting for the aha moment. I kept waiting for the gotcha when somebody steps out from behind the transporter and says, "Ha, you only think they're a bunch of vapid, sexist, not very bright hair and clothing obsessed women. Really, they're acting this way to confuse the aliens that have taken all the men." I was waiting for the hook, and it never got there. I strongly agree with Nora that I found that scene where they're kind of munching over the men, sort of, you know, kind of thinking about all of this. I was really put off by that. I found that really repugnant, and I was surprised to see it in this story. And I reacted to it really badly, and had a lot. Even I liked the characters even less when I was done with that scene. I do think it's a great foundation. I think the scenario is really, really interesting and compelling. I like the idea, and I wish there was more story in the story instead of all the dialogue. I think it's brave, and I think it's a great first try.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, this is Rajan, or Raj as I'm known around these parts. You ready, Eugene?
Yep.
Okay, great. First of all, I want to say, Tempest, that for all the people who are listening and perhaps fasting this morning, you probably ruined their morning with all the food talk. But basically, no, I'm kidding.
Oh, cheese.
I just wanted to, the good things, I think, you know, you did a great job of evoking the Star Trek feel of this without really hammering it over the head. Immediately, almost within the first paragraph, I got that strong vibe. And I was also somebody who pictured Janeway right off the bat, possibly because of the whole hair-changing incident. But I also thought that you handled the dialogue really well. It felt really natural, the way that the characters flowed from one to another. But like everyone else, or what most people have said so far, I had difficulty grabbing onto the story. And at first, I thought, oh, this is great. This is a Star Trek story with an all-female crew or mostly female crew. And then as I was going through, I thought, oh, this is a Star Trek story with an all-female crew written by a bunch of clueless male writers, being a parody. And then as I went through, I think my difficulty was that I wasn't sure what you were trying to go for, you know, what you were specifically trying to parody, if it had to do with, like other people said, if it had to do specifically with the show or the people who liked the show or, you know, things that they never experienced in the show. Like, I think the some of the conversations would have worked if there was other things going on. But the fact that they kept harping on certain things made the characters, you know, seem, I guess, as other people have said, vapid and superficial. So I think, you know, I also think that this was a great, experiment in what you were doing, but it didn't feel like a story to me. And I feel like my gut reaction was the ways you could make it better, improve it, were basically be to strengthen, you know, your message, what you're trying to do, or at least come, you know, I guess pull out the angle that you're going for, and then couch it more in a plot. Because I think you know, like David said, with that Buffy example, there is a plot going on in the background, but I think it needs to be pulled a lot further to the forefront, and I think it needs to frame the parody and satire aspects, and I think that way it'll be easier for people to get through, and there'll be something for them to follow, and there will be a moment where, you know, things come together. But I also think you need to strengthen what you're trying to say. I think you need to figure out exactly what you're trying to say, and then, you know, trim away a lot of the excess, which will probably be a lot of the dialogue about, you know, hair and stuff like that. And I really actually found the part at the end interesting, where they're trying to kind of like declare their independence and have this kind of safe haven, or at least how I read it, safe haven of a ship for like women to come and, you know, be the crew. And I really wanted to see more of that. I wanted that to be more of the story. And so, yeah, that's me.
Yes, this is Tom. So I really love the central concept, the contrast of the story. You know, you're used to having space opera be all bombastic and, oh, the planet's going to be destroyed. Let's run our ship and get there just in the nick of time and fight off the evil bad guys, and everybody's super serious. And it's really lovely to have that be contrasted with like, oh, you got a new haircut, because you don't see that done. And I think that's the central comedic concept is really strong there. Listening to everybody, I realize I missed a lot of the content. Like, it just went over my head. I didn't get the Star Trek references. Well, that's because I haven't watched much Star Trek, so that's understandable. I guess listening to Nora, there was something going on with the men and their personalities having been sucked out that kind of makes sense when I hear her explain it, but I didn't see that. So I won't speak to that much because everybody covered it. What I'd like to address is why I don't think it works as a comedic piece, if that's what you were going for. And just in terms of a couple of concepts, one, there's this concept in improv comedy they call it resting the game, which is if you want something to be funny, you can't beat it all the time. Like, you can't go hair. One way to go about it, like, the intrinsic humor here is the contrast between the hair and the bombast of space opera, I think. So you one way to strengthen it would be, okay, give us some hair, but then, oh, there's this dramatic situation. And in the middle of a dramatic situation, what do you think of that guy? We had some moments like that when you were reading and people laughed out loud when you had that contrast, unexpected and immediate. So if you had those contrasts, I think that would help. And the other thing would be varying up the beats between the bombast, varying up the beats so it's not, let's say, food, clothing, hair, which are all kind of objects and similar. If you can think, if this, what else? Like, if they talk about hair, they talk about probably guys also. What else do they talk about? How can you vary up the beats so that each time it makes sense? These people would do it, but it's something different and not something we've seen before. So each time it's this unexpected thing that we don't see it coming, but it makes a lot of sense coming from these people. So that's just in terms of the comedy, because I think the central comedic concept is really strong and you can make it into a comedy piece and not necessarily a flash piece, if you like. Now, on the content side, I have to agree, I struggled with understanding the message because it felt like there was a message and a social commentary there, but I wasn't sure what it was because, like, these women all throughout seemed like the bad stereotypical women who are really inefficient, unproductive, like nobody I actually ever have worked with in a work environment. So it would seem like something you would normally advocate against, but they seem to be the good guys. And yeah, I was waiting for that, like, hook or something to turn that around, like Chris was saying, but I didn't really see that. But again, yeah, I have to agree with everyone. It's a really bold attempt, and I think the central concept, the comedy concept, is gold, and you can really mine that for a lot.
Thank you. You don't know about Star Trek? How did we let this guy in?
I know about it. I just haven't watched much of it.
What? We have to fix that. We have to have a move that. We have to have a marathon. So thank you guys all for your thoughts. This basically was essentially, I decided that I wanted to write a space opera piece about women who are talking about hair, clothes, food, and boys. And so that's what I did. All the stuff that happens in the background sort of all came about as a way for me to have them talking about these things, and but they still have like a job to do. All of it was like meant to be background. It was, you know, I was just trying to like sort of give hints of what was going on while they had these conversations. But essentially, I was sort of spurred to write this piece because I was really annoyed with the frankly sexist reviews that I kept reading of Sex and the City 2. And I've never seen Sex and the City 2, and I've never watched a whole episode of Sex and the City. But what annoyed me about all of the reviews of the movie were that instead of focusing on what I had read, like, feminist critiquers talking about what was wrong with the movie, these other critiquers were like, all these women do is talk about hair, clothes, boys, and food. And that's just stupid. And I'm like, that's not stupid. Like, talking about these things is not stupid. You may not like it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what makes it a bad movie. There are plenty of other things that make that movie a bad movie, but not like that. And so I was like, oh, I'm sick of this. So I decided to write in the manliest genre possible about women who are talking about these things. So that was basically all of where this came from. I wasn't necessarily going for satire, but it did sort of end there. What I was just trying to do is, like, it was basically just an experiment of me, like, saying, you know, I'm going to put these four women in a room who's probably recognizable to many of you, and just see what happens when I just, like, decide to get them to talk about these things. So, yeah, that's basically where the story came from.
Well, what was happening in the background?
They encountered the scene, and their government decided that they wanted to make war on the scene, and they felt that that was wrong. And part of the reason why the government was making war on the scene is because they refused to understand them because they had become xenophobic and silly. And so they just decided that they weren't going to take it anymore. And so they gave the crew a choice. They said, either you can join us, or we can put you on this planet with purple oceans. And so some of the crew went off to the planet with the purple oceans, and they flew away.
Wow,
that is completely not, yeah, I totally did not get that. Okay.
Right.
Huh. Hosts, I'm not a member of the group, but host's privilege. A couple of things I got about it, and this is something I say every time I read a K. Tempest Bradford story. Wait. Radio. Right?
Wait, I have to write this down. Okay, go.
Okay. Also, it just reminded me that the planet they could be going to could be a while away. For those who are familiar with it, right? Okay. For Joanna Russ used it in two different universes, both in the fabulous short story When It Changed, and which was the novel she put it into?
Somebody, I don't know.
The Female Man. The Female Man.
I haven't read The Female Man yet.
Oh.
Not yet, but I'm gonna.
It's a fascinating book. I also thought there was a touch of Tiptree in there, the women men might see, or something like that. It's sort of, because it's something that she might have played with. Anyhow, that's, you know, just as a listener, because I didn't read the story very carefully before I listened to it, and it was very verbal.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'll end up with what I started with: radio.
Maybe it's a play for voices.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm inferring and suggesting. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know what I mean?
I thought Tom made a really good point about changing up the beats, because the moment where everybody laughed out loud was when, because there's a serious talk about the you know, we've lost our way, blah, blah, blah. And then she says, "Oh, how is that? That goat cheese is really good." And everybody laughed because it followed something serious. So you might want to consider interspersing the comedy with some of the, contrast it with more serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that I didn't mention, this is Eugene again, is it was interesting because you had the first two characters we see are the captain and the major, and that sort of sets it up as they're going to be archetypes of characters that you've seen in like every science fiction story, or certainly like in Star Trek. But then you have the doctor and who's constantly referred to as Jones, and then you have another character named Sam, and maybe that's like a more direct Sex and the City reference. But I think you have to choose one or the other. You have to either make all of your characters these archetypes and only refer to them by their role on the ship, or you have to give them actual names and actual personalities, you know, make them into full characters. I don't think we even know the name of the ship at any point in the story, which was probably intentional and is kind of interesting. And I also just, I sort of noticed in a lot of places that characters were constantly, like, touching each other and, like, squeezing each other's hands and shoulders and things. And I think I would also... I'm sorry?
And grinning.
And grinning. So I would also try to just vary up the behavioral, like, descriptions as well, you know.
Tempest, I mean, when I was reading it, I thought, actually, I appreciated the fact that, you know, you could do this scene where people were just talking on the ship in, like, this downtime. Because, you know, like other people have said, you don't see that on shows like that. But
except Enterprise.
Right, but what?
Dear God.
I don't like to acknowledge that show. What undercuts the message for me is that the impression I got was that that's all they did, and they didn't seem like a very effective crew because it seemed like they were focusing so much on this non-work stuff. And I think maybe if you just threw a few elements of them doing their job and doing, you know, an adequate or a good job, then I think that makes it work. But it I guess the side we see. You don't get to see a lot of them actually crewing the ship or doing anything. It seems like you could get the impression that other people are doing all the hard work and they're just sitting around eating and talking the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's what you were going for. So. Mm-hmm.
If I might add to that, I think that's where your opportunity is to show all this fascinating backstory. Like, that's how you build up the big cosmic conflicts and the problems they have, which can totally coexist with the comedy of hair and men and food, and in fact should coexist with that. I think that would be a lot more powerful, as Raj said.
Yeah, it's like those scenes on Star Trek Deep Space Nine where you have Kira and Jadzia in ops and they're gossiping about guys that they're dating and talking about their relationships. And there's actually like one episode, I think late in the series, where Sisko comes out of his office and he's like, is anybody actually going to do any work today? You know, and I sort of like the fact that, I mean, we do this, many of us at our day jobs, I think, you know, we work and we hang out with our coworkers as well, and you can have more of a balance with that. And I just made that Enterprise reference, and I just realized in the one season of the show that I saw, a lot of plot was discussed around dinner, and you always had like the cooks coming in bringing the meals in, and that was kind of the image that I went to for this piece. And I urge you to move as far away from Enterprise as possible.
Well, it wasn't part of that thing from Enterprise, because like you, I only watched like that first season. I didn't even watch it all the way through. But
Enterprise doesn't need a reboot; it needs a do-over.
It needs to be blown up. But like one of the only things I liked about that show was the fact that occasionally they would sit down and have dinner together, and I had always kind of felt like that was sort of missing from other Star Treks, like, you know, In TNG, they had the poker game, which is where some of that interaction went on. And then they didn't do a lot in 10-4. They just sat around talking about plot when they were drinking. Like, I don't understand. But and then on Deep Space Nine, like, as you said, you know, Kira and Dax always used to have these, like, great conversations that would happen, like, in between scenes. And surprisingly enough, like, Voyager was a huge sort of, you know, influence on this story. There wasn't a lot of that in Voyager, which made me very sad.
They had the pool hall.
Had the pool hall and the holodeck with the strangely naked ladies wandering around a lot that Tom Paris dealt with.
I had some issues. I'm not a fan of Candace Bushnell, so the fact that this is Sex in the City sort of informs a lot of, now I sort of get why I had such reactions. I do think for somebody who hasn't seen a lot of Sex in the City, you truly nailed a lot of the tropes of Sex in the City.
Right. So well, because it's not hard, because it's the same note over and over again.
The whole idea of the chatting over the meals, I think. It's interesting, though, because Sex in the City, those four women are essentially equals. There were a lot of times in the story that I thought, wow, they're awfully free with their captain. And she, you know, there's not a lot of power base there. At one point, the major actually kind of has to reassure her. And I get that you're going for a certain thing here, but still in all, she's the captain of the ship. And I just thought, you know, is she the captain or is she ain't? You know, is she in charge? Is she the authority figure or isn't she? And I know that's tough given the fact that these four women are
kind of, you know, moving off of each other in these different ways.
Well, yeah, I would ditto that and say that's one of the reasons why, to me, the women seemed ineffectual. I think it was Raj that was saying that, you know, the dialogue wasn't just, you know, the dialogue was kind of charming, and the dialogue would have worked if the women had seemed effectual and competent in between that. But because it was hard to see that necessary functional structure, because they weren't functioning in the way that a crew normally should, that was one of the things that actually didn't make it work.
So. I guess part of the thing is that I sort of envision the ship, or at least these four women in particular, not necessarily, like, these wouldn't necessarily be conversations they would have with, like, an ensign, but that these four women in particular saw themselves as equals, even though one was the captain, one is the major, which actually, in my envisioning of it, they were actually on the same level, because the ship is, never mind. But anyway, so all of this is in my head. But I saw that they think of themselves as equals, because that's just a philosophy I have of how societies or like small societies such as, you know, ships, crews should work. That there's like a community of women who, you know, are who consider themselves equal, and they like spread that out to everybody else. That's like a personal thing with me. So either I have to like go with something that's more traditional top-down hierarchy, or I just have to figure out a way to make to bring that more across and to make it work.
Or I think you acknowledge it. I mean, you acknowledge it and then show that it's different and why it's different.
I know that, changing subjects for a second, I know Chris and Nora were a little bit squicked out by the objectification of men in the story. And I was wondering myself, why would the men remain on the ship, knowing they're going off to some world where men turn into mindless husks? And I think the answer should be they want to get laid. And they're so happy they're going to have sex that they're willing to go and become mindless husks.
Good. Reinforce that stereotype, so David. Step up to that, my friend.
I think it's a great thing.
Why you're freaking?
It's a great it'd be a great satirical point to make. This is my point.
Okay.
Yeah.
I objectify men all the time. I mean, you know, not like to their faces or anything. I don't like call out, "Hey, baby," on the street.
Well, see, that was why I thought that was why I thought you were going for a Heinlein parody, because, you know, and there have been some conversations about Heinlein in the blogosphere lately, because there was an article on Tor, some focus on him on Tor.com. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
because
one of the things...
We should mention, because there's a new biography.
Right.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's been pointed out in some of the feminist sites discussing Heinlein was the fact that all of Heinlein's women were, yes, sex positive, but they were all sex all the time, and all with Heinlein's stand-in characters. So, you know, it wasn't so much that, you know, they would have been, you know, in your story, that the men would have been happy about, you know, finally getting a chance to get laid lots, but that they wanted nothing else. And that was what it kind of seemed like. You know, that to me was what made this scream, you know, Heinlein parody to me, because it felt like Heinlein's women done over as men.
I would like to make just one observation about Heinlein's women. His youngish girls, like Podkayne in Podkayne of Mars, are fully fleshed out. And his older women, like in Magic Incorporated, are fabulous. His problem is when they can menstruate. Then they turn into those characters that you mentioned. Man. But if it's before or after, they can be real.
I have read limited...
That's a sad trip in there.
Yeah, that's disturbing. That's disturbing.
For me, all I can think is if you switch up the genders, and it was a group of all men with seven women saying, well, they'll just learn how to deal, you know, how gross would that be?
Well, that's true. Like, that
makes it not work for me.
Okay, right? It was still gross with men.
I was trying to get to, and I didn't get there, where the captain was like, no, you know, it's...
That's the part that bothered me most of all, is that the captain would speak about members of her own crew that way. Mm-hmm. That what that says to me is she cares less about the men than she cares about the women, in which case she's not fit to be a captain. Mm-hmm. I know that is a lot to read into something that you want to be very light and frothy, but I still went there.
Okay.
Yeah. Ditto.
Okay, well, we have like 10 minutes left before we have to start the outro music, in fact, a little less, before this program.
ends. So I think that it's time for people to either sum up what they want to say about the story, or if you like, you can each outro again, talking a little bit, tell us a little bit more about your current projects and where people can find you. It's your call, guys. Which would you... yes, Chris?
Can we? Is it okay if we talk a little bit about KGB? Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Just this will be what I say, and then everybody else can say whatever the heck they want to say. Since Matt Kressel's not here, I'm going to plug the KGB raffle that's coming up.
All right.
It starts October 11th. It runs until October the 25th. If I knew the URL, I'd say it. And since I don't, I don't. But you can go to the KGB website and get.
If you Google KGB Fantastic Fiction, you will find
raffle. Then yeah. you will indeed find it. And basically, what you can do is you can go online. There are going to be lots and lots and lots of really fabulous prizes. And things that you can bid on for $1 a throw.
Yeah,
it's a Chinese auction.
Prices.
It's $1 a throw. It's a Chinese auction.
Should not.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mention prices because we're a non-commercial station.
I apologize.
I know it's a non-commercial event, but we don't do that.
Okay. Anyway, we've had lots and lots of people like Peter Straub, Neil Gaiman, Jim Freund,
K.
Jemison. I'm sorry. So there's lots and lots of stuff that has been donated, and it's a good chance to help out the Fantastic Fiction.
You can win a keyboard used by Neil Gaiman.
And signed by Neil Gaiman.
Wow.
You know, all kinds of ARCs, manuscripts. The mind boggles. So I just wanted to.
Yeah, last time we gave out WBAI wormholes signed by Dr. Michio Kaku, and we're working on those again, although I have been thinking of a different singularity this time.
Can we give away the center of the universe now?
That is a singularity, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So just one.
But we can do lots of wormholes.
Yeah.
You see, because they're each.
But I bet the center of the universe would. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to own the center of the universe, man. Yeah.
Okay. okay, so Raj?
I just also wanted to mention that for the raffle, we are also, as a group, offering a crit as part of one of the raffle prizes. So. In case anyone is interested after hearing us on the radio. everything that I have to promote is probably best summed up on my website, so I'll just spell that out because people probably don't know how to spell my name. So it's www.rajankhanna.com, and that's me.
Tom.
Yes, remarkably for me, I have nothing to say, so I'll give you my website as well. It's tomcrosshill.com. That's CrossHill.
And
read his fiction and read his blog. It's a really good blog.
And when does Writers in the Future?
Before I met you, I was reading your blog.
Oh, excellent. And yes, to answer Chris's question, so the Writers of Future anthology is available for pre-order on all the websites right now, and it should be out in late October.
Cool. There we go. My mic is on. So actually, I just want to say in closing again, thank you guys.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Molly. No, this is Kay Tempest again. If you're not tired of hearing my voice, so I wanted to say again,
Kay Tempest Bradford.
Yeah, that. I was. Yeah. So
it's radio.
Oh, okay. So I wanted to say again to thank all of you for your critiques. As people kept mentioning, like, this is sort of a weird experimental piece for me, but I felt entirely comfortable giving it to all of you to tear apart because one of the hardest things as a writer is getting critiques that you know are honest but are coming from people you know want to help you. So it's really cool. And thank you.
You're welcome. Our pleasure, Tempest.
Yeah, thank you.
I am David Mercurio Rivera, and I guess my most recent story appears in the latest issue of Black Static, number 18, which is a preeminent horror magazine out of the UK. It's called Tu Sufrimiento Shall Protect Us.
It's interesting to me that you've sold a few pieces in the UK.
Yeah, it's a running joke. It's a running joke in the group that I have groupies.
He is big in London.
Groupies in the UK. So yeah, I've sold five stories to Interzone and this one to Black Static and actually Nature as well is a British publication where I've had a story.
Brilliant.
So yeah, brilliant indeed. So thanks for having us on the show, Jim. We always appreciate it. It's a lot of fun for us.
And it makes great radio. It does. It really does. Because I'm not interested only because we get really good fiction this way. But I do believe, and it seems to be true, that listeners, at least to this program, really are interested in the mechanics and the art and the craft of writing. And I get writers on the air, big names, and people say, what do you listen to when you write? How long do you do it? What do you do? And I sort of picked up on the idea that people wanted to hear about that. We did a couple of shows with Douglas Cohen and John Joseph Adams about mm-hmm. slush piles. And I used to be a slush pile reader at Galaxy Magazine. And it's so this is a fabulous, no longer experiment, a part of Hour of the Wolf.
Mm.
So thanks back at you.
Okay, and
collectively.
We all enjoy the process as well, I think. And my website is mercuriorivera.com.
Spell it.
MERCURIO Rivera.com.
Very good. And Eugene.
Hi. I want to thank Tempest for giving me an opportunity to talk about Star Trek.
Superman's next.
Yeah, all that useless trivia comes to bear. I should have mentioned earlier that I've been running these Star Trek rewatch posts over at Tor.com with Tori Atkinson, and we just wrapped season 2 and are about to hopefully get into the Variable season 3, mostly bad, but there's some good ones in there. So again, this is Eugene Myers. I write as E.C. Myers, and I realize that the last name can sometimes be misspelled, so it's ecmyers.com, and I think my next story will probably be in Shimmer Magazine, so please buy it and read it. Thanks.
Gotham Lit.
And this is N.K. Jemison again. I actually have bunches of stuff to promote, so I will try and limit myself. I have two more short stories coming out soon. One is in the UK anthology Postscripts, and that will be a New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina based fantasy story with dragons that I read as part of the Nursif reading last year.
That was fabulous.
Yeah,
that was fabulous.
We have
it on recording.
Oh, really? Well, we're looking for a reader with a New Orleans accent. So, yeah, we're trying to figure out if we can find somebody that has that.
Actually,
the
I think
proper.
I can help with that.
Okay. I also have a short story that'll be coming out. I'm not sure when. In Weird Tales, a cyberpunk story. Of course, I do have a novel out. The 100,000 Kingdoms in its trade paperback form is already out, but the mass market comes out on September 28th.
Ooh.
So if people want, you know, the little version, then it is going to be out soon.
It's only 5,000 kingdoms?
Yeah, the you know, smidge of kingdoms. Also, the audio version of the 100,000 Kingdoms came out at the beginning of this month from Brilliance Audio. So those that want to hear it in audiobook form can do so now.
And presumably radio listeners would want like
yes,
that.
Yes. And I spoke with the artist, the actor who did that, Cassandra Freeman. I love her voice. Her voice is perfect for the character, so I think it will be excellent.
Does she do it in an Aramary accent?
I have not actually heard it myself, honestly. And there is no Aramary accent.
Yeah, the Aramary thinks so.
So that's it for now.
Wait, I heard a rumor there might be a sequel. Is that true?
Yes, there are two sequels.
There are two sequels. Yes, it is a trilogy, the Inheritance Trilogy.
Yes, as I mentioned, book two
is
coming
out. But it is time for Simon to inherit the airwaves.
Gotcha.
As he comes in. So I need to thank collectively Altered Fluid, those present, those not present.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I will be back next week, but on recording, a pre-produced show with, Nalo Hopkinson. And the week after that, I'm not sure, probably Karen Lord, maybe Sherry Tepper. I'm still working that out. I have to figure out the Graham Slight program and all this stuff. Lots of great stuff in the can. Lots of wonderful people coming to New York to record more John Sprunk. So, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Simon Locally with As I Please. And in the meantime, enjoy yourselves. Have a great week. Good morning. What is it?
And you are tuned to WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 on your FM dial. And our studios are located at the very bowels of the financial district here at 120 Wall Street, a stone's throw away from the East River, and just down the block from Trinity Church, WBAI. And good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please for this, the 18th day of September in the year 10. And I do have a bit of news to impart to you before I begin this morning's proceedings, and that is the astonishing and quite sad news indeed, a report from Lost Wages, Nevada, that unless things change remarkably and that mighty soon, the Liberace Museum will close. Well, I heard this news, and I said, what would Las Vegas be without the Liberace Museum? One of the best-kept secrets of Las Vegas, perhaps, but a tribute to a man who showed you what entertainment was all about. And it is with a certain amount of pride, and yet at the same time, humility, that I announce that Mr. James Irsay and I are being flown out to Lost Wages, Nevada, to engage in a special fundraiser for the Liberace Museum. We will be given time on the public radio station out in Lost Wages to try to raise the necessary funds to keep Liberace's spirit alive. Irsay will, of course, be doing his many, many wonderful covers of Liberace tunes. Irsay is actually one of the great piano impressionists. He can play in different styles. Now, you may not think, you may say, well, what? It's a piano. All pianos sound like, oh, no, 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 no. And he can mimic the style of Glenn Gould or Didi Horowitz or, well, you name it. You know, he's just got that sort of ear. But when he does Liberace, I can tell you, the joy that emanates from him is palpable. Because when it comes right down to it, there are piano players, and there are piano players. And then there was Liberace. I am not sure exactly when we will be going out. James and I have to coordinate our schedules, but they have decided to bring in the big guns from the East Coast to save the Liberace Museum. Hopefully, it will come at a time when I will be, shall we say, spared having to save this peculiar museum that is WBAI. Well, good morning, comrades, and hello. And we will do what we can to keep the Liberace Museum open. just say this then about that. If management wishes us to perform certain duties while on the air, it behooves management to make certain that the equipment works so that we may perform said duties. The story so far. Philip Marlowe has yet to be hired to investigate the shooting of a man named Waldo in the corner bar down the block. But he was a witness, and so willy-nilly is involved. It was just by chance that Marlowe was on the scene, and had the police held him a mere 5 minutes more, he would not have met the mysterious damsel in distress Waldo was looking for when he died. But the man who killed Waldo is not leaving anything to chance. He shows up at Marlowe's place, his .22 drawn, but the girl distracts the killer just long enough for Marlowe to flatten him with the surefire knee to the groin. The girl's gone again, but back come the cops, and Marlowe, with the chivalry that is his gift, protects the girl by feeding the detective an account that is accurate, but not entirely truthful. He leaves the girl out of it. The cop will take the collar, and Marlowe returns home to find the girl waiting for him in her Cadillac coupe. The man called Waldo was a blackmailer, and she had arranged to meet him in order to buy back a string of pearls that were not a gift from her husband, Mr. Frank C. Barsley, hydroelectric engineer. It turns out that Waldo was Marlowe's neighbor, having recently moved into the apartment below. Marlowe agrees to search for the pearls and breaks into Waldo's flat. No pearls, as Marlowe expected, but another dead guy, strangled and hidden in the wall bed. A small man, of South American origin, with a Mauser still in his shoulder holster. No identification, no money, but a set of car keys from the Packard House, a high-class showroom in Beverly Hills, with the name Eugenie Kolchenko and an address. Marlowe sends Mrs. Barsley home and considers the spanking new Packard parked on his block. He retrieves the car keys and goes for a drive. And now, the conclusion of Red Wind by Raymond Chandler. Thank you. It was a small house, near a canyon rim, out beyond Sawtelle, with a circle of writhing eucalyptus trees in front of it. Beyond that, on the other side of the street, one of those parties was going on.